Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Every new year brings hope and trepidation. 2009 is particularly loaded on both fronts. Hope in a season of change in Washington. Trepidation over a brutal economy and unsettled world and wars. Do things get better or worse? This hour, On Point, big thinkers on the economy, the world, and what's ahead for 2009. What's your hope, your fear for 09? Are we headed out of the woods or deeper in? We have a great couple of thinkers to help us look ahead today. First from California, Laura Tyson is here, professor of global management at the University of California, Berkeley Haas School of Business. She's former dean of London Business School and chairman of the National Economic Council under President Bill Clinton. She's on the boards of AT&T, Eastman Kodak, and Morgan Stanley, a major voice in the world of business, economics, and government policy. Laura Tyson, thanks very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
And with me in the studio is Noah Feldman, celebrated Harvard Law School professor and prolific foreign policy writer and thinker. President Bush tapped him at age 33 to help draft Iraq's interim constitution as senior constitutional advisor to the coalition provisional authority in Baghdad. His most recent book is The Fall and Rise of the Islamic State. Noah Feldman, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Laura Tyson, I think we have to go to money first in these days. Do you see this as an up, down, or sideways year after a brutal 2008 on the financial and economic fronts?
Well, I think, I hope that it's largely a sideways year. I don't think it'll be an even year. That is, I think the first half to 9 months of this year is still pretty rocky. The best we can hope for is that a number of significant policy changes, some of which have already been made largely by the Federal Reserve, some of which will be made by the new Congress and new president, will add enough dynamism to demand in the economy that in the last half to last quarter, things will begin to pick up. It won't be a particularly strong year, I know that, and I do think the first half of it will be quite rocky.
And the downside risk, if the stimulus doesn't kick in hard and effectively, we've got people still talking about a big potential swoon, deeper crash. How serious do you see that risk, Laura?
Well, I think that what economists would normally say in a situation like this is the downside risks are greater than the upside risks. That is, we are in a situation where this is a world, it's become a world phenomenon. We have countries around the world, whether they are all the developed countries, are basically in recession, including the United States. We're looking to the emerging market economies to be the only source of growth in the world this year. And they depend upon us for a lot of their exports. So that's why I think you'd say that we need a lot of strong and continuous government policy, and not just from the United States, from the government of Japan, from the government of China, from the governments of Europe. And what I would say is the outcome for the year depends very much on what these governments do.
Noah Feldman, you're our big foreign policy world affairs thinker here, but the economy seems to have driven almost everything in the last year. I mean, is it the driver of everything else? When Laura Tyson talks about these things depending on what governments do, is it economic policy that ends up driving the big picture on every other front this year, or do we have just as big decisions to make, choices to make on straight up foreign policy fronts?
If we were drawing on a really blank slate, then I think it might have been the case that the economy would have dictated the commitments that we would take on in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and elsewhere in the world. But we're not.
Mm-hmm.
We're, in fact, right in the middle of something.
Mm-hmm.
We may have undertaken it because we thought the economy was doing very well. But
Iraq.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
tremendous cost.
Mm-hmm.
But now that we're in the middle of them, from a foreign policy perspective, and this is also relevant to the economy too, there's no turning back just because money is tighter. So it will inevitably be the case that we'll have to be less aggressive in terms of things we try because cost is going to become relevant. But we can't really say, let's change our policy in Iraq or let's change our policy in Afghanistan because of the financial circumstances that we find ourselves in.
We've got a lot more to look at on the economy, but let's take these two wars, Iraq, Afghanistan. Do you see 2009 as an up, down, or sideways year here when you look at each of these conflicts?
In Iraq, this is really the make or break year. we've made very substantial progress relative to where we were. Things are much, much better than they were a couple of years ago, in the sense that you do have in Iraq factions who recognize that they have a lot to gain by working together. And as we slowly, slowly, slowly draw down our troops, and I think President Obama has already been signaling it will be slow, the question is, will the Iraqis be able to do it on their own? Will the center hold? There's a lot of risk. There's a lot of fear. There's talk of coup, not because there's about to be a coup d'etat, but because people are already thinking ahead to the mm-hmm. time when we're gone enough for there to be a coup d'etat. Mm-hmm. That's nowhere near where we are presently. But I think that means that in Iraq, there's the possibility of a year that actually goes up rather than just going sideways. It could, however, also go the other direction. We have to be honest about that. In the case of Afghanistan, I think we're at a lower point. We're in Afghanistan now where we were in Iraq several years ago, on the brink of civil war. We've lost a great deal of control over much of the country to the Taliban, a fact that we don't like to talk about very much, but it's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And the question now is there any chance of going up? If we don't go up this year, if we don't improve the situation in Afghanistan this year, we are likely to see a relatively rapid U.S. withdrawal and essentially accepting that we've lost. I think we're at the point now where if we don't have success in the very short term, we're going to end up admitting defeat.
We'll talk about what the implications of that might be. You say there's no blank slate here, obviously, on the economic front or the foreign policy front. Do you foresee then significant changes? Obama will bring big changes on stimulus, a lot more money to be poured in. What about on the wars front, first of all, Iraq, Afghanistan? Are we really turning the wheel with the Obama administration taking office, or are they locked in to a path that's more or less familiar?
I wouldn't say that they're locked in by necessity, but they're, I think, choosing to follow the course that has been set in the last days of the Bush administration. In Iraq, the surge policy, broadly speaking, I wouldn't say that it's worked. That would be an overstatement, but it's worked better than anything else had done. And the Obama administration has signaled initially that they seem like they're going to follow that course. And in Afghanistan, the military has been clarifying over the last several months that it's very likely to do something very similar to what it considers its Iraq strategy. That is to say, militias, which we're now talking about creating, of ordinary Pashtuns in the hopes that they will side with us and against the Taliban, deferral of our forces away from the central part of the government, from Kabul towards the provinces, and the hopes that this will turn the population and turn the situation there. Whether it'll succeed is a very complex question, but it's a strategy that's been set, and here's the key point, by the previous administration, and the signal is that we're going to follow that so far. That looks like what we're talking about.
Laura Tyson, there's been a lot of talk about American loss of standing in the world. When you look at the global economy, the decisions that now await the world, and America's position in the broader foreign policy picture, including Iraq and Afghanistan, do you see America still holding the decisive kind of vote in this year ahead? Has it been demoted to one of many? Is it still driving the global situation in a way that is familiar from recent decades to Americans or not?
I think that there's a wonderful irony in the current situation. There's a recognition that the global, as I said, it's now a global crisis, did start in the United States, and that it was rooted in a failure to regulate adequately financial markets and other economic policy decisions. What has happened around the world, though, is that the world is willing to lend to the U.S. government to basically do economic stimulus and to act as an engine of revitalization of the global economy. So in the short term, I think this actually strengthens the role of the U.S. because the rest of the world is looking to us to provide the demand for the global economy and is willing to lend substantially at very attractive terms to the U.S. government to do that. It's looking to the U.S. to come in and lead the G20 effort, which started in November, the first meeting in November, to come up with a new set of mechanisms for oversight, transparency, and regulation of the global financial system, a new kind of Bretton Woods, a Bretton Woods II, some people are calling it. The rest of the world looks to us. I mean, if you think about it, the engines of growth for most of this decade up through 2008 were the U.S. economy and the very large emerging market economies. And there is a significant amount of trade and economic linkage between those economies. I think the world very much wants us to find a way out of this economic mess and will help us try to do that. They'll look to us to do it. Now, I want to say one thing in contrast to what we were just talking about on the foreign policy fund, because interestingly enough, I think there's going to be a rather significant break in economic policy. That is, we were talking, Noah was talking about the need
for continuity in some ways.
Continuity. In this situation, I actually think the severity of the crisis on economics will give room to the new administration, to President Obama and the new Congress, to really strike out in some new directions, that there really will be a change in economic policy direction. I would go simply to the issue of health care, where this recession and the loss of jobs is going to lead even more people rapidly into a lack of health care situation. That will, I think, empower the Congress and the President to begin a very long process of meaningful health care reform. So that's just an example. It's not just going to be economic stimulus, tax cuts, and spending on infrastructure, though that is very, very important. But I think that the infrastructure spending or the government spending or the tax relief, where possible, will be tied to these longer-term policy objectives like reducing carbon emissions, increasing energy independence, and developing real health care coverage for Americans.
Laura Tyson in California, Noah Feldman with me in the studio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are looking at the year in front of us, 2009, with two big thinkers, one on world affairs, one on the economy. Laura Tyson joins us from California. She's former chairman of the National Economic Council and President's Council of Economic Advisors under Bill Clinton. With me in the studio, Noah Feldman, professor at Harvard Law School, and a big voice on foreign policy. He helped put together the interim constitution under the Coalition Provisional Authority, sent out by the Bush administration to do that in Baghdad. You can join the conversation. What do you expect from 09? A turnaround on what front? More trouble where? And what are your big questions on the way ahead in 09? Noah Feldman, Laura Tyson pointing out this very interesting dynamic, though she's careful to call it short-term, but that economic trouble has put the United States, even though it was kind of sparked and maybe made in the USA, has put the U.S. back in the middle of things, has left others very willing so far to invest in the United States, and this new stimulus that Barack Obama is going to roll out, that's put American power front and center again, even though there's a very glaring weakness in the U.S. economy right now. What about in the bigger picture? Is the U.S. still the big tent pole when it comes to non-economic global issues, of which many are pressing?
When it comes to the foreign policy side of that equation, it's a striking difference. When we got ourselves deeply enmeshed in Iraq and Afghanistan and then went to the rest of the world and said, hey, we need your help here desperately, we got a very mixed message. On Iraq, essentially, most countries in the world said, no, you're on your own. And I think the reason that that's different from the economy is when it comes to the economy, we are so deeply enmeshed with other countries that if we get into trouble, they get into trouble. And that means that they have to bail us out, not because they like us, not because they want us necessarily to be the leader, but simply because they have no choice but to look to us as a potential leader. In the case of foreign policy, countries said, well, look, you dug yourselves into this hole. Now you get yourselves out of it. In Afghanistan, we've gotten some more help from other countries. But again, there's a sense that this is not a problem that the rest of the world cares profoundly about. And we are the ones who have to, already in the past administration, but it's going to be true for the new president as well, go out and say to other countries, look, you have common interest with us. We have to convince people, in other words, to listen to us, convince people to listen to our leadership, convince people whom we have not talked to in the past to talk to us. In the economic context, you say, we're having a meeting. Please show up. And people show up immediately because they get that the centrality of the U.S. economy is such that the global economy is going to be profoundly affected by what happens
and
to us.
And show up with cash. Laura Tyson, how long does that last? Does this look like the last time where that's the case? Or have China and India and others been shown as the exports recede as simply somehow profoundly weaker than we imagined they might have become?
Well, I think we have to put this in the context of long-term trends. Long-term trend was that the emerging markets were growing as a share of world output, of world exports, of world labor supply. Most of the growth in demand and consumption and investment was going to come from the rest of the world, the emerging markets. Most of the growth in the working age population for the world over the next 50 years is outside the United States in developing countries. We were going to have to, over time, see a reorganization of a global economic leadership, for example, in international organizations like the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank. One would expect that these countries with more resources over time will demand and get more say in global economic issues. So that's on course to happen. What we really have to worry about is that it happens more rapidly than it otherwise would. Or let me put it another way, but the rest of the world looking to us right now and saying, we need you to lead us out of this mess, and we will lend you significant amounts of money to do that, all of a sudden decides, you know, you guys are not doing that great a job. Maybe we'll try something else. And that would make it much more difficult because you'd see a pretty sharp decline in the dollar. You'd see a pretty sharp increase in the borrowing rates of the U.S. government. And it would be very difficult to run the kinds of deficits that are required in this situation.
What are the odds of that showing up this year? Maybe sooner and more fiercely than we imagined. A lot of things happened in 08 that no one fully dreamed of, you know, 1 year ago today.
Right. I don't actually see that as a very likely outcome this year, because the countries that might be able to make such moves that are sitting on very large amounts of U.S. dollar assets, China and Japan being two of them, have deep-seated economic interests, as NOAA has underscored, in a recovery in the United States, in health of the U.S. economy. And by the way, they also believe one of the things that happens in a cyclical crisis like this, particularly if it's such a large one, is people do forget some of the underlying strengths of the U.S. economy, which the rest of the world does actually recognize. They recognize that we have tremendous universities, we have tremendous science, we have tremendous innovation, we have entrepreneurial capabilities, we have lots of flexibility. So they will say to themselves, well, you know, longer term, continuing to want to invest in that economy is actually a winning proposition. So I'm not that worried about this dramatic pulling back from supporting the U.S. I do think it is realistic to expect that the U.S. will have to share more of its power on global economic issues like trade policy, economic development policy, International Monetary Fund policy, with other nations, because its role in the global economy as measured as a percentage of anything has been declining for a while and will continue to decline.
Noah, let me throw a few big issues at you. We start this year with the Middle East, Israel, and Gaza in particular, in flames. A lot just leveled there. Iran, with its connections to Hamas, still on everybody's mind. Some predicting that in this same year that Israel has now acted in Gaza, it may act on Iran's nuclear capacity. And not unrelated to this, weaving all the way back to Guantanamo, where the U.S. is trying to get out of those. Those are huge, but take them on.
I guess the crucial thing to me is that the U.S. historically has tried to be a world leader and has believed that in order to be a world leader, it needed to express power. And in each of these cases that you're talking about, our power is in some important way been called into question. So Israel is our close ally. Mm-hmm. They find themselves unable to protect part of their southern border. And then they decide to take very decisive action. The world largely condemns it. The United States largely backs Israel in this context.
Right now.
For the moment, at least. Mm-hmm. With respect to Iran, you have a country that gained enormously in the last several years by virtue of our getting rid of their greatest competitor, Iraq, which is self-consciously, it thinks of itself as our greatest enemy. Iran wants to be thought of as one of our greatest enemies. And there, too, our position has weakened vis-a-vis Iran, and we want to project strength. We want to show that we're powerful, effective regional players. And Guantanamo even fits this bill as well. We had this idea that somehow post-September 11th, we had to go catch the quote-unquote bad guys, lock them away somewhere, and we ended up with this idea of a place that was not going to be controlled by U.S. law, Guantanamo. It took 6 years, but eventually the Supreme Court said it was controlled by U.S. law. And suddenly we find ourselves discovering that our attempt to project power, our attempt to project to the world that we're really in charge, backfired on us, that the world sees Guantanamo as a sign of lawlessness rather than of participation in a global world. And I think to connect this to what Laura was saying, we are going to see a period now where as our economic strength slowly ceases to be as dominant a share of the world's economic power, where similarly, we have to start rethinking the way we exercise our foreign policy power so that we don't think that strength comes from, we have a gun and we will tell you what to do.
The biggest gun.
Mm-hmm. We still will need to have that from a foreign policy perspective, the same way we will want to have the greatest economy. But at the same time, we're going to have to do it in a way that corresponds to working with people and an agreement with people. And to some extent, that means we're slightly weaker. I think we have to be honest about that. It's desirable to work with people on its own terms. It's better than threatening them. But it's also a position not necessarily of the same dominance.
What gestures or real moves do you expect the Obama administration to make in this year that will signal to the rest of the world this isn't the George W. Bush years anymore on foreign policy?
First of all, I think we're going to see substantial reaching out to a range of countries that we haven't reached out to very actively before. That may not mean Iran in the first instance, because there's a real danger for any new administration of saying we want to make Iran our big people to talk to, because Iran can then embarrass you by refusing to talk to you or by making you look weak in various ways. But certainly an openness to a broader negotiation strategy there. The Israel-Palestine conflict is another conflict where just simply the act of re-engagement in a serious way will communicate to the world that we care and therefore that we think we have, again, tremendous risks associated with doing that for any new administration, but a way of signaling that we're open for business in a negotiating sense. And, you know, last but not least, I think in the way that we engage economically with the other countries whom we're relying upon, and for including, most importantly, China and Japan, I think there's also going to have to be a little bit more of a sense of humility in the way that we interact with them. And I think that can be signaled relatively subtly. It doesn't have to be a new initiative. It's the way that we are included or include other people in the initiatives that we're already undertaking.
More chairs at the table and some other big chairs at the table. Let's begin to turn to our callers from Stanton, Virginia. Holly is on the line. Hi, Holly. You're on the air with Laura Tyson and Noah Feldman.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to just talk about my thoughts about the economy. And it seems to me that our recent prosperity is based on debt. And for families to get back to, you know, being taking responsibility for their own money and their own fiscal policy, we need to be spending a lot less. So that seems like that would continue the contraction of the economy, and we're not going to spend our way back out of this, and we're also not going to have the cheap oil and resources that we had to help us get out of the last depression, as I think we're probably at peak oil now.
Though mercifully, and it's a little cheaper, a lot cheaper today than it was just a few months ago, Holly, oil.
Well, that's today.
Yeah, that's today.
We're not getting as much out of the ground as we were just a few years ago. And we use so much oil for transportation, for our farming, and I think it really will be important for the new administration to, you know, get going with trains to really help revitalize local economies.
Let us look at this, the debt issue, the debt trap maybe that the country's been in, Holly. And thanks for that. Laura Tyson, what about it? Everybody's now staring at debt from the biggest banks in the country to individual households and kind of, you know, really worried about it. People pulling back on spending, that's hurting the economy. People worried about a credit card crash that would come on the heels of the housing crash. How do you look at debt, and can the Obama stimulus make up for the distance consumers are pulling back?
Well, I mean, the idea, of course, is that, yes, private consumers are pulling back and businesses are pulling back because consumers are pulling back. And how can we generate demand in the economy if both the major spenders, the business and consumers, are cutting back? The government actually, because it has the ability to borrow and borrow at generous terms from the rest of the world primarily, can actually become a lender to the private sector, to help the private sector bring down its debt. I mean, one of the things that can happen here is you generate more income for households through, say, some form of tax relief. Households will use some of that to adjust their debt position. Let me talk about the housing situation, because we have not focused on that. I think there needs to be, and many observers believe this, and I believe that President Obama's economic team believes it as well, we need to have a serious and foreclosure relief loan modification program, because we have millions of households now with underwater situations in their homes. That is, they owe more than the value of their home. We have had a similar situation. We have some history with this. Sadly enough, it's in the Great Depression, but nonetheless, at that time, the U.S. government came in and essentially helped modify loans, making them payable over longer periods of time. Most people stayed in their homes, and the government ultimately made money on it.
Is that going to be required again?
I personally believe that we will have to do something significant on this. It does not require, interestingly enough, a huge amount of money. The estimates are for something like $60 to $100 billion, which these days sounds like small money relative to money being spent. We could actually save a couple of million households from foreclosure. And the reason you want to do that, frankly, is because the foreclosure rates bring down property rates further, destroy neighborhoods, destroy families, and erode asset value, making households feel even worse in terms of the debt they're carrying relative to the equity they hold. So, yes, I agree debt is a huge problem for American households. We did incur too much debt. We do have to save more. But to go back to John Maynard Keynes, one of the great theorists of the Great Depression, there is a paradox during a slowdown. The paradox is the more people save, the worse the slowdown is because they essentially are not spending. The good news here is that there are many, many things in the United States which we have not spent enough on. Schools, public transportation, developing a new energy grid so we reduce our dependence
and
on
soon,
oil.
By every sign, we'll be spending a lot on many of those fronts. Let me take a call from Hartford, Connecticut, and Sebastian. Sebastian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great show. I enjoyed greatly. My concern has been the loss of jobs in the United States. We have had so many jobs go overseas. Increase in automation has made us more efficient and has resulted in fewer jobs. And the increasing trade deficit with China has brought more products into this country and has certainly resulted in manufacturing jobs leaving the country.
So what do you want, Sebastian? To put up the tariff walls again and keep the factories here?
Well, I think we, as Obama has requested, I think we need to renegotiate NAFTA. I think American companies have to take on a more responsible role in the economy and recognize that they need to keep jobs in this country for their own benefit.
Sebastian, our time is short. Let us look at that. Noah Feldman, here we come back to the place where economics and foreign policy run right into each other. I mean, does the United States, Obama has talked about NAFTA and more responsibility on foreign trade. Is there any way the United States can say to China now or anybody else whose dependence on American purchasing and that business has become so clear, we're going to take steps that may not be good for you, but we have to do it anyway in the economy?
I think it's extremely difficult to do that beyond a fairly symbolic level. I think everyone understands politically that he needs to signal that he cares about American jobs and American citizens. Other countries will feel the same way. But at this time of all times, we cannot find ourselves in a trade war. It's just simply unacceptable.
So do we have the power to fix our own economy, or is the power really in Beijing in spite of its own current problems at the moment?
It depends. If you think that fixing the economy means going back to an earlier way, then I think, no, we don't, and probably nobody does. But I think that's not the solution. I think the longer-term solution is for the American economy to grow its own innovation and its own sorts of jobs, to build an infrastructure in the way that Laura was speaking about, and then to allow the new developments that happen to be ones that create new kinds of jobs. And that's a painful thing to say at an extraordinarily painful transition point. The auto industry is just the most obvious example of this, but I think it's the truth.
But Beijing's lending is one of the necessities for us to go ahead with that stimulus and that change.
Absolutely. There's no way around that.
We're talking about the year right in front of us, 2009. What do you expect? What are your big questions on 09? What do you foresee on the economy? Iraq, Afghanistan. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are looking at the year in front of us. On this January 2nd, 2009, we're looking at 09. with two big thinkers, one on world affairs, one on the economy. Laura Tyson is with us from Berkeley, California, former chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors and the National Economic Council under Bill Clinton, now at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. Noah Feldman is with us, professor of law at Harvard University. His latest book is The Fall and Rise of the Islamic State, and earlier, What We Owe Iraq, War and the Ethics of Nation Building. You can join us. Is the U.S. ready in 09 for a comeback, a slide? Will Obama change the American trajectory, change the game? Can he? Are we headed out of the woods or in deeper? Let's go to Jackie in Melrose, Massachusetts. Jackie, you're on the air.
Yeah. I'm hoping that since Obama opposed the Iraq War so beautifully years ago, I'm certainly hoping that, he will be able to lower our military status around the world, the emphasis on our military. And can we afford now in this time of financial crisis to have 737 bases, military bases all around the world in some nations that really don't want us there? And with our financial crisis here, how can we still be supporting those many bases that cost about at least $1 billion a year or more to maintain?
Let us look at it. Noah Feldman here, again, maybe, is where the economy and foreign policy meet each other. Jackie remembers Obama's opposition to the Iraq War and wonders if he'll lower the U.S. military presence around the world. You talked earlier about that gun the U.S. has held. Is it going to be smaller? Can Obama do that?
I think that President Obama is certainly going to have to lower the profile of our military presence in a lot of places, but I think probably he'll try to do that without actually lowering the amount of leverage that we have from our military presence, because that military presence plays an important role not only in protecting our security, but also in many places in maintaining regional stability. And regional stability is hugely important, partly for economic reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to maintain stability between North and South Korea, and you have 50,000 U.S. troops in South Korea for almost 50 years now,
mm-hmm.
primarily just to maintain a balance, and you withdraw them and you weaken that balance, that increases the risks of violence taking place in that part of the world. And that, in turn, would be disastrous for the economy of South Korea, but also the economy of Japan and the economy of China, which are near neighbors, just to use one very mm-hmm. concrete example. So I think that although President Obama will not be out there trying to expand our military presence, except in Afghanistan, where he said expressly that he's interested mm-hmm. in doubling the number of troops that we have on the ground, he is going to nevertheless have to maintain our place as a preserver of some degree of world stability. And I think that's going to become increasingly the focus of our foreign policy. Instead of seeing ourselves as disrupting stability in the hopes of improving the world, which is sort of what we did in Iraq and to some degree in Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
we said, well, the Middle East is broken. Mm-hmm. Let's really break it in the mm-hmm. hopes that it will turn out better. Now we're going to be in the game of increasing stabilization. And I think that, though costly, is part of aiming for economic reconstruction.
Laura Tyson, you were a big supporter of Hillary Clinton earlier in the campaign season. She'll now be, by all signs, Secretary of State.
Right.
And there's a lot of talk about boosting America's diplomatic effort in the world in relation to its military. But Noah's describing a world in which the role of the military and its capacity to stabilize is pretty important. Do you see a real shift in the sort of balance of America's presence from military to diplomatic or not?
Well, I think we just need to build up our diplomatic power. We need to. I think we've allowed our what's called in the sort of among foreign policy people our soft power mm-hmm. to erode, and we have relied on our hard military power and projection. So diplomacy is going to play a very important role. Let's go back to the issue of developing a new system for regulation, oversight, transparency of global financial markets,
okay.
which clearly have broken down here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That effort, a Bretton Woods II effort to say what should the World Bank look like in the new world of what should the International Monetary Fund look like? Should we have more close coordination among the national financial, the country financial institutions?
Mm-hmm.
Those are all questions that will be dealt, must be dealt with through a combination, I would say, of state and treasury working together. That's how we've developed great foreign policy initiatives in the economic realm before, and that's where we're going to have to do it again. The issue of development, where I would say the Bush administration has actually
done a lot through the Millennium Challenge Grant mm-hmm. and through embracing the UN goals for poverty eradication in emerging markets around the world. Those, again, require a lot of U.S. leadership on the soft power side. So I think we do have to project more of that power. I will leave it to Noah and others to try to determine in that process, can we scale back responsibly our hard power, that is our military presence in other parts of the world. I like very much his formulation that while we may not change the amount of power, the focus on stability, restoring stability to world geopolitics and to world geoeconomics mm. is very important. I guess I would say stability is a major word we should focus on.
I want to look at that word stability, mm-hmm. but if stability is the goal, and Noah, let me come to you first on this, whose stability might be the question? If we're going to have a Bretton Woods II and sort of rewrite the rules of international finance and regulation, how big is China going to be at that table? Does it really have the same goals for this next year and this next century as the United States? Is there a conflict there? Do you see, you know, do you see these two big powers, just for starters, sitting down really on the same page?
I think in the short and even in the medium term, we are very much on the same page. Stability in the sense of there not being regional conflicts is increasingly in our interest. As I said, we thought it wasn't, but we were wrong. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's also in China's interest because China is not yet the kind of military power that wants to intervene actively in conflicts. It wants to grow its economy to become the kind of great world economic power that it believes would then have the capacity to have greater impact in the military realm.
Though it's sending a little armada over toward those Somali pirates as we speak?
Because that's a great example of where stability is needed. Mm-hmm. And if they can deploy some number of ships and send the message that they care about stability, that's a message they want to project to the world. And it mm-hmm. also shows that they are players. And in the long run, I think there should be no doubt about this. In the long run, China will be interested in having the kind of global force posture that corresponds to its economic position in the world. I don't think there can be very much doubt about that. But that's not their short-term goal. Mm-hmm. The short-term goal, they would like to have an influence without conquering countries.
Mm-hmm.
They think that conquering countries is very costly mm-hmm. and that governing them is almost impossible.
Right about that. Right
exactly.
about that.
But I think – but as they grow, they will want, as a country with deep national pride, to have a role in world affairs that is commensurate with their economic growth. And in the long run, that does mean that we are – conflict is too strong a word, but that our interests will eventually diverge, mm-hmm. that our interests will no longer simultaneously be – in, because there'll be a question of who is the dominant world power, and that question may not arise for another 75 or 100 years, but it's out there.
Laura, more immediately, if Obama and others, let's say, assemble a Bretton Woods II to sit down and design a new or modified architecture for world finances, do you see the U.S. and China as on the same page or in potential conflict right there?
You know, I think that that China has been in the global economy for it embraced a open global economic path more than 30 years ago. It has been tremendously successful for them. They have been a responsible economic player in most respects. The last time there was a major financial crisis in the world in 1997 through the end of to 1999, they were very responsible in terms of what they did. They've been the first country out there to adopt a major economic stimulus package for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think they have exactly the same desires that we have at this point, and that is to turn around the downturn in the global economy and to get back on the path of economic recovery. That's why I think they're going to be continuing to lend us money. I think one of the important things to recognize here is, yes, the U.S. households built up a lot of debt. The U.S. built up a lot of debt. A lot of that has been financed by the Chinese. They are our bankers significantly. Now, as bankers, they are interested in our ability long-term to repay. They are interested in our ability to use the money they have provided to us to buy their products and the products of other countries in Asia and other parts of the world. So they recognize their economic interdependence with us, and we need to recognize in our policy our economic interdependence with them. I think they will, for the foreseeable future, be a player that will work with us on developing a way out of the economic situation that we currently confront. I do think longer term, just as Noah said, as our role in the global economy diminishes relative to theirs, not so much absolutely. It doesn't have to, that our output doesn't have to fall, but theirs is going to rise as a share of output. We can expect them to want a greater voice. And to a certain extent, the voice of a country that's a developing country in Asia is going to be different than a developed country like the United States.
No doubt.
But I don't think for the foreseeable future that is something that we need to worry about. That's, as Noah has said and I've said, a long-term trend. I would say I worry about one thing, though, and I the U.S. has for the last, really, 50 years, more than 50 years, really been willing to take on the leadership of the world in terms of developing the economic institutions that pull the world together, leading on trade liberalization, leading on development, leading on international monetary policy to help out countries that get into trouble. We've been the leader on that. We provide the public goods. We're in that sense the government of the world, trying to create a stable architecture for the world global economic system. As we step back from that, who is going to step into that? If it's a group of countries, then by definition almost, there's going to be more conflict because not every country is going to see the situation in exactly the same way. So the U.S. has to get used to the fact that there will be more players sitting at the table. The danger is that there's no one nation that's going to step up to play the kind of hegemonic leadership role which the U.S. played in the last 50 years, which was a very important part of having global economic prosperity and stability.
Of course, that model, with no small amount of tarnish on it right now, where the hegemon sort of drove the thing
exactly right.
Off the cliff.
That is exactly right. And that, as you said, you started the show by saying, you know, the rest of the world looks at us, and what do they see? They do see us as an irresponsible, in that sense, hegemon. But on the other hand, they are looking to us to take leadership to bring us out.
Let me get one more call here. I think, Noah, this will be in your bailiwick. Wynn in Afton, Virginia. Wynn, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. Great show today.
Thank you.
What I've been concerned about is that our military is exhausted, and our country is also with this war. Had we not had the turnaround we've had in the last 15 months, then I think our country would have, in essence, left with its tail between its legs.
When you say left, do you mean Iraq?
Yes, I mean Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Our efforts are now transferred to Afghanistan, largely, or in the process of that. I think that's a very smart move on the Taliban. What they're really doing is just bleeding us, as it were, much in the lines of Ho Chi Minh. We will tire of Afghanistan, too, both financially and in the terms of our military. If we have to leave Afghanistan, essentially, with our tail between our legs, as we could have in Iraq, what will be the effect, both geopolitically and economically, especially as it would relate to the U.S. as a safe haven for dollars?
And when you ask this with a military background yourself?
That is correct.
Noah Feldman, how about it? What are the chances of the U.S. leaving Afghanistan, as Wynn says, with its tail between its legs, and the implications if that ultimately happens?
It remains possible. I think the caller is absolutely right to say that we just got out of Iraq barely, and of course we're not out of Iraq yet. We still have 150 or 160,000 troops on the ground there. We can't take our eye off the ball. But we are shifting attention to Afghanistan, and I think there will not be the same amount of time in Afghanistan that there was in Iraq. The public will not tolerate it for as long, and the military, which is very overstretched, cannot tolerate it for as long. But if there is substantial directional movement in a good way in the next year, then I think you will have the morale and the public support for the idea of continuing in Afghanistan for something that looks like a stable arrangement. It will not even be anywhere near as democratic as Iraq is, which is saying something.
Mm-hmm.
But if that looks possible, I think you could get the public behind it, and the military would stick it out. If it is not, then the caller is right. We might be in a position of essentially leaving Afghanistan in some form of defeat. the world, I think, will look at us and say, well, nobody succeeded in Afghanistan. Alexander the Great didn't succeed. The British didn't succeed. You know, the Soviets didn't succeed. But I don't think the consequence to us will be what Osama bin Laden predicted and what happened to the Soviet Union after Afghanistan, which is this was the straw that broke the camel's back. I think our underlying strength as a global superpower remains very great, mostly because there isn't a significant competitor.
And the answer in Afghanistan, is there a counterpart to what worked in Iraq? Is there really? Are we going to be sort of allying with warlords there to,
yes,
to have a province by province deals?
Yes. I think the best case scenario in Afghanistan is power sharing in which the central government does not have very substantial authority, but in which the various local warlords, regional lords, call them what you will, reject the Taliban or reinterpret the Taliban as a less virulent force, in which we get some greater degree of human rights, especially for women and girls, and then allow Afghanistan essentially to run itself. It will not look like a democracy. It will not even look like a democracy in the way that Iraq looks like a democracy. And that's the best case scenario.
Laura Tyson, we've got literally half a minute. I'm going to ask one more economic question because the fear of things chunking down again on the economy is still very much out there. If listeners want to look for the signs things are turning up or down in the next few months, what should they most look for on the economic front?
Well, I think the indicators would be what's happening to announcements by firms about employment levels, what's happening to announcements by firms about investments. I mean, this is the key thing over the next several months is job loss and the extent of job loss. And I would also add the extent of bankruptcies, because in a situation like this, there are companies which in normal credit circumstances would absolutely survive and instead will be forced into bankruptcy. So I would actually look at very simple things. One is sort of employment numbers, unemployment numbers, announcements by firms about their employment, and also number of bankruptcies.
Watch the headlines, and we will too. We're very grateful to each of you for being with us today. Laura Tyson joining us from California. Great to have you. Thank you so much for being here, Laura. Happy New Year.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Happy New Year to everyone.
And Noah Feldman, author of The Fall and Rise of the Islamic State. Happy New Year, and thank you, Noah, for joining us today.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.